Welcome to Co-Evolutionary Culturing, composting power over culture from the inside out, the podcast from Starter Culture. My name is Sarah McFarland, and I'm here with Claire Milne. Today we talk about power and what we mean when we use that word, what power is, and what power over culture is. To clarify what we mean when we use those two terms. And we also begin to unpack the idea of composting power over culture and why it's necessary in these times and how to do it. We both share stories from our own lives and experience of how we have composted power over culture and how we're still on the path of the never-ending transformation to relational culture that we so long for. And as we begin invoking the four directions of east, south, west, and north, and the four most ancient of our ancestors, fire, water, earth, and air. We ask that our wise and well ancestors, and the wise and well ancestors of this place where we live, where you live, come along and be with us alongside this journey of composting power over culture. We ask for any guides and allies, human and other than human, especially those who've been through massive change and transformation in the long history of Earth, to come and guide us. To guide us and protect us in the field of not knowing, releasing control of how things should be, or knowing better. We offer our hearts and our intention in this time of rupture to tending the dying culture. Hospice, the power over culture that is in the beginning of collapse. And we invite you all, humans and other than humans listening in, to meet us here at the crossroads of the inner and the outer. This present moment, which is the meeting of past and future. All those longing for transformation and committed to expanding consciousness beyond that of modernity into an imaginal way of being in conversation with life and death to co-create a way of being with Earth that is reciprocal and relational.
So we use this term inner-led change a lot at Starter Culture. And one of the really important aspects or specific nuances of this term, inner-led change, is that we've understood that inner work in and of itself doesn't necessarily lead to change in the outer world. That what is instrumental and essential in that is a power analysis. That the inner work we do is held within the framework of what we're calling, our term is power over culture, the way that we're pointing to what some are calling modernity or late stage capitalism. And we have particular reasons that we call it that. And I'd love to ask you, Claire, to unpack a little bit this term, power over culture, that unifies the power analysis that we hold at Starter Culture, as well as the deep inner work that we feel is essential for inner-led change to be effective in the world or possible in the world.
Yeah, thanks. It kind of feels like it's been such a rich journey, I think, for both of us and all the different kind of tendrils we've been tending, to kind of really drill down into this kind of like, well, yeah, like, why is it that this power analysis feels so essential to this lens of inner-led change? You know, we really starting from this place of recognizing how essential this inner dimension is to social environmental change. And if we're not paying attention to that inner dimension, then we just end up replicating, you know, the same patterns out in the world. Hence, you know, us at Starter Culture kind of birthing this kind of entity to have that inner focused on our social environmental change. And then in all of the kind of research we were doing and the hundreds of kind of cups of tea conversations that we had around this kind of, what is it, how is it to integrate an inner dimension into our social environmental change? It started to become really apparent that power was a really important theme, you know, that actually there was almost, it kind of felt like, oh, there are kind of different flavors of inner work. There are those flavors of inner work that are focusing ultimately on individual well-being, you know, it's very much, and, you know, tapped into and part of a much wider kind of spiritual context, of course, that really includes us as a whole into being. And yet there was something that kept coming through that we saw that, like when we start to relate to how that inner work relates to change in the outer world, power is the kind of common denominator. It's like we're looking at our relationships with power in regards to power within our own psyches and within ourselves, and power in our relationships with other human beings, whether that's in, you know, our groups, that whether that's just in relationships, whether that's in our families, whether that's in movements, whether that's between countries, whether it's in, you know, between politicians. It's like, you know, this power dynamic there. And then the power dynamic between the human sphere and the other than human sphere. And how do we, you know, how does power, our relationship with power, play out in that human to other than human dimension? And what does that have to do with the crisis that we're in now? Yes. And so it was so clear to us that, oh yeah, power, like unless there's a power analysis, there's a very high chance that inner work is just going to replicate the same status quo, because without recognizing all of these different dimensions of how power plays out in a, you know, in the individual and collective and other than human psyches, then we just play out that same power over dynamic that seems to be at the core of the immense pickle that we're in right now, and at the core of what we're calling civilization trauma. So I guess what I'm just going to drop this last piece in, and it feels like a big piece, and then I'll hand back over to you. But it feels so important to be getting clear about what do we even mean by power? You know, it's like it's so easy for us to roll this term off our tongue, kind of composting power over culture. It's become like a mantra to us. And it's like, wow, what if we break that down? And like, what do we even mean by power? I think, you know, when any of us are talking about power, I think we often mean different things without even realizing it. And so for us, well, at least for me, and it'd be interesting to see if this does fully resonate for you. For me, when I talk about power, I'm effectively talking about energy. I'm talking about life force. And so when we talk about power over, it's kind of like it's an exertion of life force over someone else, in some way, or over the other than human dimension. It's like, you know, and there's something of the kind of bigger picture, what we feel like, you know, what Starter Culture is working towards is around this liberating the life force to be able to move through us without it getting stuck and without it almost being available for that power over domination. And how do we allow life force to be shared, you know, so that it isn't something that gets stuck and centralized because of the kind of socio-historical construction of distortions that allow some people to be able to centralize that power and to use that power in ways that prevent others from having such free-flowing access to it. Mm. And there's something about how so often we talk about power in this way that it's something that we either have or we don't, mm. as opposed to a more zoomed out perspective, which is, what if power is life force and it's how it moves through us and the degree to which we perhaps can say we have power or we feel empowered is the degree to which our body and our being as a vessel is available to for that power, that life force to move through us. And for me, it's like looking at that in this socio-historical context of recognizing that when we're born, there are infinite circumstances that shape the degree to which this particular being is available for power to move through it. And, you know, obvious things like gender and the color of our skin and the country we've been born into, and, you know, any number of things have shaped that, you know, have shaped the availability of power to move through us. And and there's so, I mean, it's so complex. There's so much more I could say. I'm going to kind of leave it there and see what you want to kind of riff off that. And I'm just as I'm saying all of this, I'm realizing that we could easily fill a whole hour and a half's podcast simply talking about what is power. Like, yes. I thought we could scrape the surface of what is power. Because as soon as we look at it intergenerationally, as soon as we look at it ancestrally, which then takes us into the realms of karma, not in the kind of more popular culture idea of karma, but like the deeper sense of karma. It's like, you know, power just becomes this really, across all dimensions, fascinating thing that is way more complex than I think most conversations give space for.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Thanks. Well, you opened up so many different... touched on so many different things there. There's a million ways I could go. It just, well, you just said the word karma, I thought, yes, I think epigenetics might be a scientific word for what you're pointing to with that kind of karma that you're pointing to, right? Well, that's kind of what we're up to here in this podcast, is to examine together what is power, to reveal our power analysis in order to build the foundation of why compost power over culture, or why inner-led change has to do with power. Mm. Adding to what you said about power being life force, which is, I totally agree with that, the piece I would add to that is, it's life force that moves in cycles of life, death, life. That life force is never, you know, unchecked growth, this idea of progress that is a linear, you know, always growing principle in late stage capitalism, that there's no space for death or regeneration or renewal or winter or quiet or rest in that kind of paradigm, which is in and of itself a power over pattern, right? Of production and generation and growth and progress is given power over death and regeneration and rest. And so to kind of name right at the heart of what we're up to, that we honor and track power in cycles of life, death, life, that there's this cyclical, earth-centric understanding of how life force moves, that we are actually beholden to as animal, human creatures in earth community, that we actually also are held within these cycles as much as we fight them. You know, that's a whole another podcast about the industry of how we fight death and transformation, and change. So that's the first thing. So this life, death, life cycle piece, around how power moves. And then the second thing I want to say is, it's so incredible how power is such a bad word in so many circles. You know, it's like, I know folks who won't even use that word because it's so identified with power over, with political power, military power, financial power, power in a way that is not serving of the life-death-life cycle, the earth-centric practice and the flowering and blossoming and transformation that we are capable of as human creatures and earth creatures made for. So there's also some reclaiming happening, you know, that we use this word power in a really honoring way to point to this life-death-life cycle, to point to the life force, the life energy that moves through each human, each tree, each creature, that in and of itself, of course, there's fluctuations and, you know, more or less that can be accessed in a particular time, but we all inherently have access to and capacity for massive amounts of life energy, life force. And it's so much about the relationship we have with our power and the way, as you were pointing to, the way power moves through us in relationship with ourselves, other humans, and the other than humans. And then the third thing that I want to say that came up while you were speaking, which just was like I know this, of course, but the sort of aha moment of connecting the dots of like, right. So here's inner-led change, that when we do the inner work of tending to the parts of us that, as you said, from, you know, childhood or epigenetically, intergenerationally, ancestrally, when we tend to those survival strategies within us that either are about diminishing our life force or controlling the life force of others to get our needs met. When we do that inner work, then the whole way that we relate with the world is about honoring the inherent dignity and beauty of each person's aliveness, right? And there's a lot more space then for all of us to participate in this life-death-life cycle. Yeah, just wanting to connect those dots, that it's directly related to how we, when we do our inner work, this is why inner-led change, when we do our inner work, healing work, and we have a reckoning with our own relationship with power, with our own life force, and with the way that we use it, abuse it, minimize it, control it in our lives, we're automatically permissioned to expand and relax our grip, you know? And then power can flow through us in such a creative and generative way. And in a way that's actually what we talk about, you know, building of relational culture. It's even it's possible. So when we talk about wanting to, you know, create the world our hearts know is possible, to quote Charles Eisenstein, it's like this is the essential piece to be able to doing that. Because if we don't do this inner work and we don't have this reckoning and the healing and the transformation within us, then how could we possibly be in relationship in a different way in the world?
Beautiful. The piece that's really coming through for me when I listen to you is just this reminder of how, in light of what we're framing here, with this kind of lens on power as an energy that moves through us as the life-death-life cycle, it automatically makes clear that power is not something that one person can have or not have. It's a flow between beings. It's between people and between creatures, between everything. So there's something about this recognition that the shift from this power over culture that we're so steeped in, you know, this kind of conditioning in us to try and control or submit ourselves to control in our fear of what will happen if we exert our power, our truth. It's like there's something about what is it that allows us to make ourselves available for that flow rather than defaulting to the protective strategies that we've learned that are about controlling that flow of power, whether it is through exertion or diminishing. In that, just when I was hearing you speak, your version of that, it's that reminder that, oh yeah, the only way that we can really move beyond power over culture and our conditioning is to learn to be vulnerable, It's like, you know, it's that vulnerability of not controlling, of pausing, of not doing the usual thing that is basically a protective strategy to not feel the sensations that arise when we don't know what to do, you know, when we don't just do the conditioned thing, you know, when we just sit in that pause of relationality, you know, relationality with whatever, whether it's relationality with myself or with another human being or another creature, is pointing to the true transformative potential of power as a shared resource, as a shared energy, lying in each of us actually learning to become more vulnerable and more comfortable with the vulnerability, the inherent vulnerability that comes when we pause and we don't just default to our learned ways. And there's something in the exquisiteness and the excruciatingness of that vulnerability that is infinitely powerful. I mean, to be in the presence of someone that is able to stay with that awkwardness, that we've probably all had that experience at some time where, you know, somebody that has that capacity just to stay calm in that awkwardness and not skip over it, not skip over the kind of unknownness of this particular moment to kind of make themselves either bigger or smaller than us or whatever. It's like, wow, that's true power. Like, to just rest in the unknown feels like a flavor, at least, of what perhaps a sharing of this life force of power might look like, to allow power to be in control rather than us.
Yeah, beautiful. What you're just pointing to here is for me an example of what we mean when we are saying composting power over culture. Because to compost, so the reason we use this word compost is because, first of all, we're not wrong or bad for having protective strategies. We're not wrong or bad for acting out in particular ways, immature ways, to get our needs met. And the world isn't only awful. You know, there's beautiful things about the world that we live in. And so the idea of composting, which we know from, I happen to be a passionate compost pile maker, is that the bits that are left from food, making food, or the garden, last season's, you know, garbage, gets piled up and created so that the heat will increase within the pile. And everything that's within it breaks down. And there's this incredible inoculation, this incredible, talk about life energy, you know, that the mycelium and the microbes and the bacteria and the insects and the worms and the mice and, you know, everybody that is involved in a thriving, writhing, hot, you know, transformative compost pile to make the most delicious, nourishing, life-enhancing food for what comes next in the garden. And so really that's what we're up to with exactly this, is how can we compost the ways that we have diminished or exerted, controlled our life force, power within us? How can we compost those ways, receive their goodness, their gifts, and compost the, you know, what's left over, so that we can avail ourselves, open ourselves, exactly what you just said, to let power flow through us, life force flow through us, the wisdom that's inherent in life force, that is inherent in earth, period, in earth cycles of, you know, four seasons, or rainy periods and dry periods, or night and day, or the moon cycles, you know, whatever the cycles are, the way that life energy power is constantly moving through creation. Yeah, just kind of really hearing this beautiful example of composting power over culture. And I wonder if you might perhaps give another example of, since I've sort of set the framework for the composting part, if there's anything else you want to say about the, maybe not the particular examples, but sort of this, the next layer down of the structures of what we're up to with that?
In hearing you, there's something of the kind of being reminded of our intentionality around the term composting and what it is that the way that we are attending to this, that is about recognizing that change doesn't happen simply by telling ourselves and each other what's wrong and that we think something's wrong. It happens through us really diving into kind of what's actually here, and examining from the inside out kind of what our own relationship is with, for example, being on the receiving end of someone that we're experiencing perhaps as abusing power. And like, what does that feel like from the inside? How do I compost my relationship with power with view to the information I'm getting about what it's like to be on the receiving end of somebody else behaving in that way, which is very different? You know, it's a very different positionality. Mm-hmm. It's like, how, you know, and trusting that in the composting of my own relationship with power, by meeting myself where I'm at and then allowing that to be composted into this heat, that is how I will make myself more available for life force to move through me, which means I can meet other people from that place, which is going to, from our experience anyway, massively increase the chances of that dynamic shifting, mm-hmm. rather than it being a pointing to and making somebody else wrong for how we think the way they're relating with power is problematic. Mm. It's like we compost power from within ourselves, and then that means we show up in the relationship in a completely different way. And that's what then hopefully is what leads to the other person's behavior kind of being in a dance with that. And it no longer allows that same dynamic to exist, mm-hmm. because we've changed the container. That feels really important. And I what's been coming to me as I've been kind of listening to you, and maybe this is for this conversation, and maybe this is another conversation, but I feel I would love us to be talking very directly about, you know, how have we, you and I, been, how are we in this process ourselves of composting our own relationships with power? You know, that some of that might be within starter culture, some of that may be prior to starter culture, but I feel like, you know, I would love to grapple with that and share the learnings to make it tangible, you know, to kind of really show this is why we feel it's so important, is because it's about the tangible transformations in our own life and relationships.
Let's do that. I can imagine that being a whole other, you know, a second part or a continuation of this examination that will allow us to really both dive in and reveal our own vulnerable heart and our own learnings, as you said, and also how those, you know, build, connect the dots to how that's, why that's become, or how that's become essential to the design principles, for example, at Starter Culture. You know, how we, our own experience is, of course, the laboratory of experimentation and learning that we are then wanting to offer the world. Yeah. So when I hear you share that, Claire, about this dynamic between when we get upset or triggered by somebody else's behavior and we get into a blaming, a situation of really blaming them and being completely outward focused, of course I have to think about the drama triangle, that we put ourselves into this role of the poor victim. You know, and there's this terrible persecutor who is being awful and damaging us. And then we start frantically looking for somebody to rescue us, to be on our side, to take sides with us, to intervene for us, to protect us, to stop the ouch, you know, to stop the terrible behavior. And of course, I'm not speaking here about experiences and times and places where harm is being done, you know, where somebody is harming another physically or psychologically, that there isn't, that there shouldn't be absolute responsibility taken by the person who's causing harm, and there shouldn't be, you know, a kind of kind and compassionate justice process and rupture and, you know, a repair process that happens, if possible. But on the psychological level, we have these roles that we slip into so easily because they are like the way we function in power over culture. Like, it's baked in to the way that we're in relationship with each other. And when I started to notice, when I learned first about the drama triangle, and I started to track you know, and the inner level of like where I was putting myself on the triangle at any given moment, to just, it was like an inflammatory illness, you know. It was just like, it was this constant suffering, you know, inner suffering, and me causing outer suffering, running around this triangle. You know, we talk about healthy shame and toxic shame, and healthy shame is this moment where I would realize, oh my gosh, I just was acting like a perpetrator, and I really, that's not in alignment with my values. It's not the world I want to live in. But also healthy shame of like, oh God, I was just totally in my victim and was, you know, completely acting out in a way that I'm really kind of embarrassed about, you know. Or when I would catch myself being a rescuer, which has, it's so seductive because it has this sort of like really delicious feeling of having done something good and help people. And boy, so many of us change agents in all kinds of realms love this role of rescuer, of like, there's, you know, we identify the perpetrator and we identify the victim, and we go, you know, riding in on our horses to save the day, to save Earth, to save whoever. And it's, again, it's not that these behaviors shouldn't be stopped that are harming, they should be, but who of us and how are we engaging in that behavior is what we're trying to point to here, which is the inner led change, the inner work of examining, when do I find myself in this triangle, and when do I relate to others also in one of these roles and put them there by relating to them in that way. So I'm gonna, before I could give an example, but before I do that, I want to, you know, obviously invite you to also say something about what the drama triangle is for you.
Thank you. I mean, I'm not sure there's that much I need to add. I feel like you've just done a beautiful job of describing the drama triangle. There's something of the kind of recognizing how when we really commit to waking up to how we are acting out those different roles within the drama triangle, that is what unleashes power to move through, for life force to move through,
yes,
the collective entity. Yeah. It's like, it's when we get stuck in these roles, whichever one of them, you know, whether the persecutor, the victim, or the rescuer, it's like whenever we're kind of taking that shape and that posture and behaving in that way, to whatever degree of consciousness, we are then distorting life force, because we've taken a shape that is based on conditioning and protection and fear, effectively. They are positionalities and ways of being that are trying to control, you know, that they've learned ways that, bless, parts of us have are trying to protect us from feeling things we've learned to be frightened of feeling. And so there's something about really recognizing that when we commit to becoming ever more aware of when we've fallen into the shape of one of those different positions on the triangle, we are blocking life force. We are distorting power, and we're part of power over at that particular moment. And it's so easy for us to presume that when we talk about power over culture, then that's just those that fit into a persecutor shape. You know, it's those kind of abuse power as a kind of a bully, oppressor, or a whatever. And there's something about all of us getting really real with taking responsibility, that at any given moment, if we're inhabiting any position on the drama triangle, whether it's the victim or the rescuer or the persecutor, we're colluding with power over culture, because somebody can only be a psychological persecutor if somebody's willing to take the victim role. Somebody can only be a victim if somebody's rescuing them, you know. And again, as you've already said so beautifully, it's like, we're not saying that there aren't real situations where people are actually the victim of oppressive, abusive behavior. That obviously is prevalent. This is a psychological model that, you know, there's a recognition that if we can clean out our psychology of those habituated ways of being, we can free up power to really move through in way more generative and transformative ways that seems to be what the world is longing for through us right now, if we are to move beyond these times.
Yeah, exactly that commitment and capacity to do the inner work and free up that life force that can move through us means that we're actually so much more effective to actually stand up and say no and stop the kind of oppressive, violent, suffering-based ways of being that modernity is built on, that power over culture is built on. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, just recognizing how ineffective, certainly in my experience, action I take from a positionality within the drama triangle, how ineffective that is, you know.
Yeah.
Because life force isn't moving through me, you know, it's stuck in a particular shape that's conditioned by all sorts of socio-historical conditions that have led to that shape.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's something of that, really recognizing that this commitment to cleaning out our relationship with power over as it shows up through the drama triangle is perhaps the most powerful way we can contribute our gifts in the world. And yeah, I mean, it kind of is obvious, but cleaning out our own relationship with power is how we are most effective of transforming power in the wider world, you know, addressing the abhorrent oppressions and violence, as you say, that are going on. It's, you know, through us cleaning out our power rather than pointing the finger. And it's like how we come into relationship with the oppressive behaviors of others will be radically different once we've cleaned out our relationship with power, you know, rather than falling into one of these drama triangle positions in relationship to somebody else's relationship with power.
Wait, I wonder if you would, this would be a good moment for you to share the story or the example that you were talking about, because it, and kind of walk us through both of those, like how you were in it in a way that was in the drama triangle and what you did to transform that into a relational.
So one of the examples that I have around this composting of my own relationship with power, and particularly how that shows up in the drama triangle, one of many examples, it's a life's work, is my own relationship with people in leadership positions, and looking how historically over time, when I've been in groups where there've been, you know, there's been somebody in a leadership position, how I have spent so much time and energy kind of obsessively making them wrong, you know, seeing ways that they are in that leadership position that are problematic and abuse of power, that they're, you know, not perfect, basically. And yeah, you know, the ways that they were being were having an impact, and they weren't, you know, I still look back objectively now and I'm like, yeah, they weren't behaving in the ways that I long for a leader to behave. But my obsession of being in this really blaming kind of position, where it was all I could think about and all I could talk about and all I could do was to put my attention on what they were doing wrong, which, you know, it was so ineffective, because we all know that if somebody is coming towards you with you're doing something wrong and just blaming you, it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction that we want to push them away, because we become terrified. You know, whether we're conscious of it or not, it's like we just feel so wrong and bad. And we definitely do not want to relate with that person, because, you know, parts of it are just like, this is just going to be horrific. And so, you know, really seeing how, you know, all of my energy was on the outwardness of kind of like, they're doing this to me, they're doing this to us. And I had no capacity at the time to own my own reactions. I didn't have enough relationship with my parts back then to recognize that these were conditioned parts of me that were very frightened. And the only way they knew to relate with the fear that they experienced when they experienced somebody holding a leadership position in a way that didn't feel relational and didn't feel like there was a permeability to hear feedback, then parts of me would get very frightened and would go into a knee-jerk persecutor role. Well, it was a blend of persecutor and victim, because I was persecuting them, making them wrong, but at the same time I was going, and you're harming us. You're the one that's got the power, we're the ones that are, you know, subjected to that. So, and I think that's quite common, this blend of victim persecutor, where, you know, where it's passive aggressive, basically. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been a long journey. And I celebrate now that when I catch that pattern happening in me, because the pattern still comes, you know, it's not like I think it takes a long time, if ever, for the initial reaction not to flare up in us of the drama triangle, because it's got centuries and centuries and centuries of history in our beings epigenetically. But now when I notice a part of me taking that shape, and it's like I can recognize the energy of it now, because it is tracking it. It's like, yeah, I remember a teacher of mine saying, this is maybe like 15 years ago, saying you need to know the feeling and quality and story of your core wound, like your telephone number, like you know your telephone number. And it's so true. It's like now when the energy of that kind of person blaming part starts to arise in me, I can recognize it, and I can be, oh, okay, there's that part that's frightened. Right. You know, that part is actually frightened, or that part is protecting a part that's frightened. You know, that's a protective energy that wants to make somebody else wrong because there's a part of me that's scared. And then I can start to come in, then I'm in relationship, and then I can start to kind of actually rehumanize that other human being. Remember that it's really quite likely that they're not intentionally trying to do something. And maybe, you know, maybe it's not that never happens. But as soon as I come into relationship with my own stuff and feel the shame, like you spoke, it's like there's a shame that happens. And I can meet the shame and know that persecutor in me doesn't define me. You know, it's like that isn't all of me. And then I can start to be more relational, and then I can start to actually think about, well, how might I want to actually be in a conversation with that person that might be effective, as opposed to like just alienating them and making them want to push me away. And you know, there's more space, there's more like, oh, I can get curious about this. So yeah, that's a one example that I could share.
Great. Yeah, for my own tracking, it sort of feels like it's a pair or a complementary piece to what you were just saying. You were pointing to sort of knowing, as beautifully said, like having to know your core wound, like your phone number, so you recognize the psychological, energetic, emotional signature of it. And the other part of it for me is recognizing particular environments that are that I react to in a particular way that is power over. So there's this combination for me of stress that usually has to do with too much to do and too little time, expectations that I think somebody else has of me, or expectations that I have of myself, and feeling alone, having to kind of get everything done all by myself. When the environment around me and within me create these conditions, then I get really tight, I get really controlling, and I get controlling with myself, I get controlling with my dog, I start yelling at my sweet dog, because she's not going fast enough, you know, or I get snarky with my partner, or I get really like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I start giving commands to people who could maybe help me rather than asking them for help. And so I get into this kind of inner tyrant, this sort of, you know, trying to control and direct the whole world, so that, because I have all this inner pressure of having too much to do in too short of an amount of time. You know, recognizing that one of me, bless, you know, my inner dictator, my inner tyrant, is like, oh yeah, when I recognize that I'm in conditions like this, there's a particular energetic signature and psychological signature that happens that I start to kind of rev up into, then, you know, I have cultivated practices that allow me to pause, allow me to stop, allow me to ask for help, and allow me to shift who in me is speaking, who in me is in relationship with the environment that I'm in. That I'm no longer the victim of circumstances, right? Because I take the role of this like helpless victim of circumstances, and then start being the persecutor and controlling everything and everyone around me. and screaming for somebody to rescue me, that I actually have learned, and of course it's still a work in progress, you know, but learn more and more to take a step back and notice that that's what's going on and what I need to do in order to shift and resource myself, basically, so that I can do the healthy disidentification, you know, take space, back up, and bring the compassionate witness online. To notice, even just speaking that, like I notice my breath changes and all the energy begins to move down into the be ground, more grounded, and like, right, you know, that's what happens when I call the compassionate witness online and take that step back and make more space, then life energy can flow. And I can even think clearly, compassionately, and constructively or generatively, and know like, oh, in fact, I need to say no to this and take a nap, or in fact, I need to go for a walk, or in fact, I need to ask for help, or in fact, I need to just say, no, I can't meet that deadline, you know, whatever it is, in a way that actually supports me and ultimately the relationship and the outcome, you know, the positive outcome of whatever it is that I'm trying to get done. That's a little bit of a peek into my experience of my inner tyrant.
Well, thank you for the tender courage to share that with us. And there's something in hearing you share that and, you know, speak with this tender courage and of this compassionate witness, it reminds me both what you shared and what I shared in terms of like this composting of power over culture as it shows up in us into relational culture. It's like, it's when we start to wake up and disidentify from these parts within the drama triangle. And we have that compassionate witness that can kind of catch what's going on and kind of loosen the kind of grip that these parts and stories have on us, that then we feel safe to start to come into relationship with the other. I mean, I'm sure most of us have that experience of like something's happened relationally with somebody, and we, some part of us is frightened to kind of have the reparative conversation, you know, like that aversion to kind of to any sort of conflict really, and therefore any sort of repair. And really recognizing how it's when we're in intimate relationship with our own parts and our own psychology of what's happened in the particular situation relationally, and we've become less identified and convinced of our positionality in that, that suddenly the spaciousness and the safety starts to kind of come on online, that it's like, oh, and now I can actually have a conversation with that person. You know, like in my example, it's like, well, if I'm completely conviction that this person's really wrong and bad and some part of me is also quite frightened of my own persecutor, because of course if you go towards somebody with that energy, then you're probably going to get a backlash or something. Where if I've managed to shift and shift within myself and create more lucidity, and I'm not identified anymore with that persecutor, even though I can still hear the voice, I can feel a safety in my system to move towards that person, because instead of coming at them saying you were doing this, I'm coming at them saying, oh, you know, I'm really aware that there's a part of me that kind of was really falling into this kind of persecutoriness of making you wrong. And what I realized was because there was actually a very young part of me that was very scared. And, you know, I don't want to be making you wrong because I know that's not helpful. But it feels, it does feel helpful just to let you know that there is a part of me that can feel really scared when I'm relating or whatever, however it comes through. But it's something about this unblending and disidentifying from whatever positionality on the drama triangle that seems to be the key to feeling the safety that's required to start to move into reparative relationships.
And the only thing I would add to that, or as a caveat, is like when the relationship is actually safe enough. You know, it's there's a particular level of privilege or a particular level of to be able to do this work, and there's a particular level of safety that has to be in the environment, has to be safe enough for us to come with that vulnerability. Otherwise, it's so much better to not come with the vulnerability and to get out of it, right, if you can.
Yeah, for sure. The situations we're talking about are within a context where we're not actually at risk of harm.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, it's a very different situation if there's real harm on the table. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much for diving once again into these deep waters with me, Claire. It's a joy to do this dance of starter culture with you and find our way into the continual emergence of the kind of tender and fierce power that is possible, the way life force can move through us when we enter into these kinds of conversations. It's really very beautiful. Thank you.
This is Co-Evolutionary Culturing, composting power over culture from the inside out. And we are Starter Culture at www.starterculture.net. Please check out our website for programs, storytelling events, webinars, and sign up for our newsletter. And while you're there, check out our Approach to Change with the vital ingredients and design principles for creating relational culture in these times of crisis and collapse. If you're so moved, please join the conversation on Facebook and LinkedIn to grapple with us at the crossroads of inner-led and outer change. The music today is Uma's Song by Tamsin Elliott from her album Frey. Thank you very much, and see you next time.